You're listening to Chris Farrell's On Watch podcast from Judicial Watch.
I'm Chris Farrell, and this is On Watch. Welcome, everybody, to On Watch. We're glad you're taking the time to join us, whether you're watching us on YouTube or Rumble or listening to us on the audio version of this podcast on Spotify or any of the other platforms out there. Thank you for taking the time to join us. Please be sure to subscribe and leave us a rating. Send us your comments. We want to know what you think and what you'd like to hear us cover or watch us discuss. Joining us today, real treat, Sarah Bedford from Washington Examiner. Sarah, welcome to On Watch.
Thanks for inviting me.
You're very welcome. Sarah has done tremendous investigative reporting work, not just on Hunter Biden, but of course Hunter Biden's kind of the flavor of the moment. You've done tremendous work, broken some great stories. We're sort of at a lull just before we came on to the show. We talked about how there's been so many developments so quickly on the Hunter Biden issue, and now they've appointed a special counsel, which is a topic we can discuss, but there seems to be sort of a pause. If you can, give us a little roll-up as to, you know, what's just recently happened and where are we now with respect to Hunter Biden?
Well, that's kind of what's so interesting, right? For years, nothing was really done with this. In 2018, U.S. Attorney David Weiss in Delaware opened this investigation, or the investigation opened under him. There was an IRS investigation, a separate FBI investigation that eventually merged. So for years, that kind of sat dormant. And we now know that that was because steps were taken to slow walk it. The excuse of the upcoming 2020 election was used to sort of stymie the investigative steps that the IRS and the FBI wanted to take.
Isn't it interesting that because of an upcoming election, no one should take any action? But we have an upcoming election now, and there's all sorts of action being taken against.
Right. You could say there's something of a double standard
here. A little disparity of treatment. But yeah.
Then we have, in the run-up to the 2020 election, the discovery of this laptop that Hunter Biden famously now abandoned at a laptop shop in Delaware. And so a lot of insight was gained into the foreign business dealings that he engaged in while his father was vice president. So then, you know, slowly investigators and investigative reporters started to go through that, and there was a sort of drip, drip, drip from, you know, 2020 to the beginning of this year of stories that came from the laptop, and here and there people who would come forward, like Tony Bublinski, who gave, you know, the one big interview where he talked about things he knew about the Biden's dealings. But you fast forward to January 2023, and then Republicans take the majority in the House. And these congressional investigations have actually, somewhat surprisingly, produced a lot of fruit. And so everything we sort of know recently, and specifically what's relevant is Joe Biden's involvement, has come from those investigations and some of the whistleblowers that have come forward. And as you mentioned, just in the past few months, we've had two IRS whistleblowers come forward with allegations about slow walking. We've had Devin Archer, a former business partner, also talk to the House Oversight Committee and then give what I thought to be even more illuminating interview to Tucker Carlson.
Right.
We had the announcement of a plea deal from the U.S. Attorney's Office in Delaware, and then a pretty shocking day in court where that
it
fell
blew
apart.
Up, right?
And then the appointment of a special counsel, and that's how we got to today.
And, you know, what's interesting is in sort of doing your rundown or narrative there, you made it sort of like an offhand comment, but I think it's really critical or key, is you said, surprisingly, you know, House investigators actually uncovered vital information, because we've seen, I mean, I've been doing this job for 24 years, right? I've seen all kinds of House committees do investigations or have hearings, and they kind of really don't.
Right, you're at the mercy of what the federal government wants to give you, right?
Right, right. So talk about that a little bit. What do you think, what's the difference in this particular instance, how these House committees have actually been able to uncover, churn up new stuff? What's the big difference now?
I think they've been a little bit creative in the way they've gone about this, right? Specifically the House Oversight Committee. A lot of what we know about this network of shell companies and the payments that were, you know, sort of snaked through to the Biden family come from the House Oversight Committee's decision to subpoena those from the banks. You know, they did ask the Treasury Department for suspicious activity reports, but they focused on the Biden business associates like Rob Walker, like Devin Archer, and the payments that were routed through them, it's notable to point out that they have not yet subpoenaed any bank records specific to the Biden family. They've not asked for Joe Biden's records, Hunter Biden's records, James Biden's records, Joe Biden's brother, Sarah Biden's records. They're not touching that yet. They're just starting with the associates. And you know, there's probably a reason for that. Maybe the banks are more willing to hand over records if they don't have to deal with the sensitivities of it being, you know, related to the sitting president.
Right.
But a lot of what we know about the money Hunter Biden made came from that, or whistleblowers who have stepped forward without the authorization of the Biden administration.
So the suspicious activity reports, I don't remember how many, there's hundreds. I don't remember the exact number. But I was driving along listening to Dan Bongino, and you know, he has the benefit of actually having been a Secret Service agent and done financial crime issues for a living. So he's not just somebody thinking out loud and, you know, writing opinion pieces or something. This is a guy who actually did it for a living. And he was very emphatic that the fact, I mean, if there was a business and they had one or two suspicious activity reports, it was a big deal. It was a, you know, call in the lawyers and the accountants and everybody has to explain it. So the fact that there are hundreds of these reports associated with, let's just call it the Biden enterprise or Biden network, you know, he tries to give you an idea of the scale of that. It is outrageously off the charts that this one collection of people, all closely associated, either through business dealings, family relationships, this network of little LLCs, these limited liability corporations that they created, it is breathtaking. And he pounded away at it for like an hour discussing it. But I don't think the average person understands that. You know, getting a suspicious activity report from the Treasury Department is not like a parking ticket. I mean, it is a big, big deal.
Right. I mean, the amounts of money, right, have to be large enough to trigger the suspicious activity reporting requirements from the banks. There has to be some other element of suspicious activity, right? The fact that it's, you know, involving a shell company, or the fact that the company making the payment has, you know, been in trouble with law enforcement in some way in a foreign country. So, right, these are not insignificant. And, you know, Joseph Ziegler, which is one of the two IRS whistleblowers, the one who was initially anonymous, he's the one who opened the Sportsman investigation for the IRS. And he said, you know, part of what initially drew his attention to the Hunter Biden situation was this network of shell companies that he discovered in his many years of experience. If you had a complicated financial structure like that around foreign work, more often than not, actually in the vast majority of circumstances, it indicated that illegal activity was going on. And that was enough for him to open that investigation. The Bidens have never really been asked and have not tried to offer an explanation for why they needed to route their payments through so many different avenues. Why didn't these companies just pay them directly if it was all above board? There is an explanation for why they set it up this way, and it hasn't been offered yet.
Right. And it's a bad explanation, right? I mean, one of the examples, and I think people watching this or listening will kind of go, yeah, why would you do that? It just doesn't make sense. One of the techniques is they would create these limited liability corporations, which you could really do in about 20 minutes online if you're creative. It's not a difficult thing to create an LLC. But they were single transaction LLCs. So they created, you know, XYZ company, and XYZ company took in one payment and then paid out a payment and then opened and closed. And that's it. That's the only business, the only activity. And when you back up the documents for the creation of the LLC, they all kind of dead end. You know, it goes to a PO box, or it goes to another company that is a subsidiary of another company. It's all these ways to sort of insulate and isolate the transfer of money that you can't tie directly to a person. And I think that's a key thing that people need to understand. This is a very deliberate and creative effort to insulate people from being tracked for money.
Right. And why, you know, a lot of the payments were also not given directly to members of the Biden family, but were first given to, you know, Robinson Walker LLC. One of them was, you know, Rob Walker's company or Devin Archer's company. And then they would be given to the Biden family. And sometimes booked as a loan, as we now know from the IRS whistleblower testimony, so that it would try to shield that income, one, from being directly tied to the Bidens, and two, from a tax liability.
Right.
And, you know, now some of that, some of those charges for the Burisma years are time barred, the statute of limitations has hit. But there's not been an explanation offered for why it was structured that way. Maybe this is all a fantastic misunderstanding for the Bidens, and they are being, you know, persecuted. Maybe they still do deserve some sort of presumption of innocence, but they've not even attempted to explain away some of these really suspicious looking things.
Right. I think there was another sort of fun fact that popped out to me, and I kind of made a mental note, and I haven't looked it up or I haven't investigated it yet. Perhaps you know more about it. But I guess Biden, as he left the vice presidency, his tax filing for the year said he made $400,000 or thereabouts. And then the very next year, $11 million. And so there's never really been an explanation of, hey, how is it that you made 20 times more money in this period, 1 year after exiting the vice presidency? And again, there's no explanation for what's the source of this income? What did you do? How did you earn it? What was the, and to me, that's another like head scratcher. And everyone's supposed to go, oh, okay, yeah, 400,000, 11 million, no problem. And just accept it.
Devin Archer was asked this, right? Have you ever just wondered how, you know, Amtrak Joe, who's never had a job really outside of public service, can afford all these beach houses and properties in Delaware? How does he live like that? I think it's a good question. And, you know, the media and Democrats continue to say there's no evidence that Joe Biden was tied to this business enterprise, which is just, it's sort of farcical at this point because there is evidence. Now, we don't know how involved. Maybe the extent of it is just what we know. That's still involvement. And there are messages, you know, from Hunter Biden complaining about having to earn income to support the entire family.
Right.
There are emails, you know, regarding the CEFC China deal, which is, you know, one of the more recent ones, one that prosecutors might be able to actually touch, not like the Burisma situation, that suggests there were discussions about holding some money for Joe Biden should he decide not to run for president again. And Rob Walker confirmed that in an interview with the FBI. So there is a growing body of evidence, and I think that's what's most relevant and to not lose focus on, that Joe Biden was sort of involved.
So I'm looking at these Republicans who are sitting home, or I shouldn't say sitting home. They're back in their districts working, whatever that means. And I've teased a couple of congressmen in interviews about that. And they say, no, 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 we really are. We're working. Okay. You know, in my experience, the Democrats were able to move towards impeachment against Trump in about 10 minutes. And they ran, you know, Schiff ran an impeachment out of the Intelligence Committee, which had never been done before. It's always the judiciary. And he deliberately did it out of the Intelligence Committee to get witnesses into a skiff and claim that all their testimony is classified so we can't release it. And so he had this secret foundation for an impeachment. You don't see any activity, no real activity on the part of Republican leadership. They talk about, well, we're thinking about having a conclusion about a discussion about perhaps forming a committee to look into whether, I mean, it's this endless, tedious kind of approach that they're taking to impeachment. Am I being too cynical? Am I being too, or is there enough to go? I mean, could they do something?
Just to play devil's advocate, I'm not sure if there is enough for impeachment yet, because it's just started. The investigation in the House has just really started to produce serious fruit. And I think the investigation is, you know, gaining more credibility. More people are starting to pay attention. I think House Republicans could get there, but to have that effort have more credibility, maybe they should wait for the next smoking gun. And we could get one soon. You know, I mean, there's, for example, it appears that Hunter Biden's lawyers are preparing to sort of rat out the Justice Department about the way that plea deal came
together.
And one
of his attorneys just bailed out in the last day.
So that he could serve as a witness, supposedly, for this challenge to the way the plea deal came together. And so, you know, that is something that would sort of implicate Joe Biden because, you know, ultimately the buck stops with him at the Justice Department. And, you know, according to this whistleblower testimony, there were explicit concerns among investigators at the FBI, the Justice Department, that they would be retaliated against if they moved too aggressively against the Biden family. I think that smoking gun could come. Is it here yet? I'm not sure, but House Republicans have been successful so far. It's not like they've hit a stone wall. If that did happen and they weren't able to move forward, if that was the only way to advance the investigation, maybe that would be a different story. But right now, you know, they're succeeding in their efforts.
Yeah, I will agree with you that they're succeeding. I guess it's just that it's sort of the disparity of not just treatment from the Justice Department, but the disparity of how they conduct their own internal sort of processes or procedures. And I point out the Schiff Intelligence Committee impeachment. I mean, one of the great ironies of that impeachment was that the Department of Justice and the FBI was sitting on the Hunter Biden laptop.
Right. And the FD, and they, and you know.
While they impeached Trump over mm-hmm. Ukraine, Russia. I mean, they could have gone to Hunter Biden's laptop and read all about Burisma. And you want to talk about inappropriate communications or. So, I mean, there's a rich irony there that the FBI and DOJ, and I blame Barr, just stood there with their hands in their pockets and watched an impeachment take place while they had this laptop in their possession and not a peep, not a word out of them, which is horrendous in my view. So we have the special counsel who's been appointed.
Right.
But it looks like he really shouldn't be a special counsel, right?
I mean, well, he doesn't have a lot of credibility left, right? I mean, he specifically has been accused, and people in his office have been accused of misconduct with regards to the Bidens, right? Offering preferential treatment. I don't know yet, though, if it is necessarily a bad thing. I think there's been a lot of griping from House Republicans that, you know, this was done just to shield the Bidens from, you know, congressional inquiries.
Right.
I think that if that was the case, if that was really what they were worried about, why didn't they do that, you know, 3 months ago before all this embarrassing stuff came out? You know, if they really cared about stopping congressional investigations, I think they had opportunities to do that. I wonder if something else didn't happen.
I think that they believed that the Hunter Biden plea was going to slide through.
Right. They didn't think it would get the scrutiny it did.
They didn't know it was going to blow up, right? And because they get away with so much because there's a complicit, you know, unlike you, there's a number of your other your other journalistic colleagues who simply sit there and take dictation. Mm-hmm. They don't really ask too many questions other than, oh, what would you like us to write? Thank you. And then they go out and write it. So there's grounds to question whether even the appointment of Weiss as a special counsel is even lawful. Right? 'Cause the statute
says he's supposed
to
be outside of government.
Right. And so he very clearly isn't. And they'll argue, well, he's right in the middle of everything and he's already established all the facts. And why would you want to start all over again?
And isn't that why, you know, in an earlier letter to the House Judiciary Committee, he said, I discussed special attorney status, which my understanding is a different statute, which might have allowed him to stay in office. That's probably why he wanted the other title, right?
Yeah. I don't know. Like you said, maybe they'll just allow him to stay and do what they're doing.
He's required. So one of the silver linings of all this, right, is he is required to write a report now that will be made public that is supposed to explain if he declined to prosecute.
Why?
Why? And I think we are going to get insight into how that sweetheart deal came together. It's pretty clear that the Hunter Biden team wants to call out the Justice Department for offering immunity, and then when some sunlight was shined on that, taking
pull
it away because they were
right.
embarrassed. So in the filing yesterday that David Weiss submitted, he noted that, you know, there were threats from the Hunter Biden's legal team to bring up notes. I can't remember if it was recordings, but notes and you know, testimony about the way that plea deal came together. And Weiss sort of said, be that as it may, it doesn't matter what we said before, it matters what was on paper and what we said before the judge.
Right.
But, you know, I don't wonder if the fact that Weiss is about to come under fire for what might have been some pretty dirty, you know, tactics to get that plea deal through, if that isn't why. In the filing also, just one more quick thing, he noted that the day before he requested special counsel status was the day that Hunter Biden's legal team formally said, no, the deal's off. That happened on a Monday. And then on a Tuesday, he went to Merrick Garland. And then on a Friday, Merrick Garland announced it. And the Friday is, you know, notably when the Justice Department tried to formally withdraw the plea agreement
right.
for the first time.
Right.
So, you know, I wonder if that, it has more to do with the fact that Weiss is about to be exposed for the negotiations than House Republican inquiries. But again, we don't know yet.
Yeah, that's a great point. That's a very good point. One of the things that I like to do is often try to point out to people or remind them of things that either they've forgotten or they mm-hmm. should have paid attention to and they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And so years ago, we had looked at, we love asking questions about official travel. And so, and we ask all administrations, doesn't matter, Democrat, Republican, who's traveling, how much are you spending, where are you going, all that kind of stuff. And so a tremendous record that we got. It isn't even for all 8 years of the Obama presidency. I think it's like 6.5 years is where the information cutoff was. But we know, because we have the flight manifests, Hunter Biden traveled with his dad on 411 flights.
It's a lot.
26 of those flights were overseas, and of those, 5 were to China. So when Joe says, I never discuss business with my son, which has now been twisted around to be, I was never in business with my son, I mean, it doesn't pass the giggle test, right? No one would believe that you'd be on 411 flights with somebody, 26 overseas flights, 5 to China. We never talked about business.
China piece is really interesting, right? Because, you know, I feel like that's one that maybe most directly implicates Joe Biden's involvement, because part of that extended to his time out of office and to a time when it seems the Biden family wasn't sure that he was going to run for president, right? And so at that time you have, we know from the Hunter Biden emails, that he shared an office space with executives from CEFC China. We know that it was discussed, you know, the very infamous 10 held by H for the big guy email. Rob Walker confirmed when he talked to the FBI, and we know this from whistleblowers, that that discussion was about potentially holding money for Joe Biden in the event he didn't run. There were discussions potentially about Joe Biden maybe becoming a paid advisor to a Chinese company.
And how could there not be, right? I mean, let's just be very practical and, you know, set aside all the, oh, no, I would never do this. Washington is an influence and connection city. Nothing is produced here.
No.
Right? There's no
we
factory.
We have no real skills.
No. There's no real skills. It's all, you know, somebody who knows somebody who can get something done and will give you a waiver for what, you know, what you want, or you need a license to export something, whatever. It's all schmoozing who knows who.
Yeah.
So in considering those connections, I mean, I'm not like advocating it or saying it's a great thing, but it's just common sense. Why wouldn't they have a discussion of, well, you know, we have to figure out what you're going to do and who you know and how we can capitalize on this. Of course they had that conversation.
Right, well, and the irony of it is that if Joe Biden had never sought the presidency, I don't think people would have cared. You know, he's lived a long, long life. He had years of public service. You know, every ex-politician cashes out. And that wouldn't have really been such a big deal for him to do that. You know,
I mean, no, I mean, go to K Street. I mean, they're all, it's filled with all former congressman this and senator that and secretary that. That's what they do.
What's also notable about the CEFC China deal is that in the years since this happened, we're talking about 2017, 2018, in multiple court filings for Patrick Ho and for Gao Luft, a recently indicted, you know,
he's
witness.
An interesting story all by himself,
he is.
Right? We could talk about that maybe.
But in the court filings for his indictment, the Justice Department acknowledges that the U.S. government believes that CEFC China was conducting sort of a covert influence operation in the U.S., and that's why Gao Luft's involvement with them is bad. Same thing with Patrick Ho, that this is an adversarial organization, CEFC China. They were trying to, in a sort of malicious way, penetrate power circles in the U.S., and they paid the Bidens millions of dollars, and they shared an office space with Joe Biden, you know, and Joe Biden attended meetings at which Joe Biden was present with CEFC China people. So this is sort of different than all of the other ones to my mind. It's not just a company with some, you know, corrupt actors. This is a potentially intelligence operation.
Well, not even potentially.
The Chinese Communist Party.
So in my misspent youth, I was an intelligence officer, and I can tell you that there are no private corporations in China. They're all arms of the government, number one. So they're not conducting or doing anything that isn't approved by, directed by the government. And the other part of that is that a huge strategic objective for the Chinese government is this idea of elite capture, right? They're going to influence, in some way connect to, or attempt to steer relationships with very senior, very connected people. I mean, what I've just described in a generic form is what you just laid out. Okay, well, let me get the acronym wrong.
It's a mouthful.
Yeah. They're meeting with the Bidens for what purpose? Well, because they're connected and it's a question of influence and they're paying him a lot of money. And I mean, that's.
And not just Hunter, also his Joe Biden's brother.
Right.
You know, it's hard to argue just Hunter Biden was a particularly bright lawyer with this expertise. Maybe you could argue that, but why is Uncle Jim involved when he also doesn't really have expertise for this sort of enterprise as well, you know?
Yeah.
Why are they sharing an office space with Joe Biden, Jill Biden, and Jim Biden, you know? And interestingly, you know, I think this was brought up in the statement of facts that was in the plea agreement that was supposed to give Hunter Biden immunity for the things laid out in the statement of facts.
Right.
And, you know, now that immunity doesn't exist, you know, one wonders if the Biden team is worried that there's maybe legal exposure for, at the very least, FARA violations with regards to their work with CEFC.
Yeah, no kidding, no kidding. And then FARA violations are Foreign Agent Registration Act, which is a requirement. If you're going to act on behalf of a foreign government, you need to go tell the Department of Justice, hey, I'm lobbying for country X and they're paying me directly and I work for their government. And people have gotten in a lot of trouble for that.
Trump people, specifically.
Except in the case of some Biden connections, and obviously what you've just been talking about with Hunter and Jim Biden and the rest. Give me something. I just told you about the crazy trips with his dad that people just don't know about, that he made all these flights and all these long travels and foreign connections. What's something that people have forgotten or lost or has kind of slipped through the cracks, do you think, that people just should kind of go, oh, yeah, that's right, and know about?
Well, I think the CEFC deal, you know, is one of them.
Yeah.
I think, you know, there are witnesses who could speak to this, right? There's Rob Walker, there's Tony Bobulinski, there's James Gillard. These are all, like, not household names, but these are all people who were involved in this deal. And at least Tony Bobulinski has claimed he tried to talk to investigators and they weren't really interested in his story. I think that, you know, the extent to which the Justice Department did or did not look into what's pretty clearly a nefarious operation, and when other people who worked with CEFC China Interview have faced charges, Patrick Ho, notably Gao Luft, as we sort of touched on, you know, investigating the investigators, I think, is going to become a bigger part of this.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically with regards to this, you know, there were allegations at the time of Patrick Ho's trial in 2018 that the Justice Department intervened to have the Bidens' names redacted from emails and testimonies to really keep them out of that, even though mm-hmm. Patrick Ho had paid Hunter Biden a legal retainer in 2018, right? He paid Hunter Biden $1 million in 2018 to be on his legal team. Hunter Biden was not on his legal team, but supposedly it was for legal services. And this was also in the statement of facts. So I think looking at the statement of facts is an interesting roadmap that was included in the plea bargain, because this was an attempt from the Justice Department to give immunity for everything that was in that document.
Right.
So one wonders if that document was almost a roadmap for, this is where he has legal exposure, so let's
dump it into the record.
And all of that was in there. Specifically, the judge asked about this payment from Patrick Ho. Well, why was that, you know? And so maybe that's a good indication of where prosecutors could charge him. They were trying to protect him,
you know? He takes $1 million payment and then performs no legal work for it.
Well, he claims, yes, to have been retained by Patrick Ho. You know, I went back and looked through all the documents where Patrick Ho lists every one of his attorneys. Hunter Biden never appears as one, even though he received this very large retainer in 2018. And, you know, the IRS was interested in that payment because he had a tax bill coming due then. And this is a year for which it's not time barred. The statute of limitations hasn't run yet. He could be charged.
Yeah.
And yet, despite the fact that he had that influx of cash and had the ability to pay his tax bill, and by his own claims was sober at that point, he chose not to and sort of blew that money on personal expenses. And yet the IRS did not charge him with evasion. They charged him with a misdemeanor failure to file.
Which was just, I mean, no one else, if it were you or I mean, it's just no one else gets that kind of treatment.
Right.
We've bounced against the name Gao Luft a couple of times. And he's an interesting character. And he kind of popped up on the radar screen. There was some social media about him. He did a couple of video clips and said, hey, I'm being persecuted, and the only reason anybody's interested in me is because I have dirt on the Bidens. and then he kind of dropped off the radar screen. Fill in the blanks. Give us a little more detail. Who is this guy Gatliff, and why does he matter? How does he fit in?
So he's such an interesting character because it's not clear whether he's a credible witness, right? And certainly Democrats have sort of used his indictment to impeach his character and say, you know, he shouldn't be a credible witness. So Gatliff claims to have information about Biden's because he was also involved in this Chinese company, CEFC, China Energy, and he had some sort of nonprofit here in the U.S. that CEFC was funding, and he, you know, used that as a platform to allow Chinese executives and officials from this company to come and speak, and supposedly recruited, I believe it's James Woolsey, the former CIA director, to this effort, which was sort of an example that was used in court of the way CFC would operate by trying to sort of compromise high-level, credible U.S. officials, elite capture, as you put it.
Yeah.
And he was also charged with a FARA violation for doing this work without registering as a foreign lobbyist.
And this Gatliff guy, he's actually an Israeli, is that right?
He's an Israeli-American.
And he had, I think at some point he'd even served in the Israeli Defense Forces, and he may have been a colonel. That was another kind of fun fact in my head, because he's an interesting character.
But he was also charged with some sort of gun, you know, violating sanctions for an arms deal that he might have facilitated. So for that reason, you know, is he the most credible guy? We don't know. Also, he was clearly involved in this world of the same, you know, shady billionaires that like to pay for influence.
The irony is, The same sort of claims that would make him impeccably qualified to be right in the middle of it,
because
is the same thing. They'll use the same lineup of characteristics or qualifications to use it as a means of impeaching him and saying, oh, he's a dirtball, or he's disreputable, or he's corrupt or something. But it's the same set of talking points. It just depends upon who's listing him. Somebody else could say the same thing and run through the same set of qualifications, and they go, oh, you know, that, what a wonderful person to have on your board or to be a consultant or to pay a fee to. So it just depends upon who's representing or who's making making their pitch to either knock the guy down or to say that he's a genius and everyone should love him. You know, it just depends upon how they present it. So what is the last that we have on Gatliff? What do we know about him, or what's his status?
I believe he's a fugitive. I believe he was indicted, and he claims he's on the run. You know, he posts his videos from an undisclosed location. Somewhere in Europe. I want to say Cyprus. Because, you know, they're coming at, it's a political persecution, so I shouldn't have to submit to it. Which the irony is, I think maybe if he went to trial, we'd actually hear some of these claims about the Biden's involvement would be aired out.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's running.
I don't think he's willing to do it from a prison cell. You know, that's part of the problem. Unless, of course, you know, maybe the Bidens will follow the Mark Rich Clinton example and they'll just give him a pardon. What else do we need to know? We're kind of in an interesting kind of gear shift point, right? Where we've done a lot of stuff, a lot of stuff's come out. There's still some things kind of developing or hanging. We don't know how it's going to play out. What do we need to know? What's your view?
So I think it's kind of useful to sort of view the two tracks of the congressional investigation separately, right? You have the House Oversight Committee is looking just at what did the Bidens actually do? They're subpoenaing bank records. They're trying to talk to former business partners of Hunter Biden. And a lot of that stuff is kind of already out there. They're just sort of getting the receipts, right? We know that Hunter Biden made all this money and had all these connections, set up these meetings, but they're sort of getting the documents and the on-the-ground, you know, eyewitness testimony. The Judiciary Committee and, you know, because of the IRS, the Ways and Means Committee are doing this separate, equally important investigation into why has this taken 5 years to come to fruition, or even longer. I mean, this stuff with Burisma happened in 2014. So we're going on a decade since some of this allegedly illegal activity took place. And, you know, that investigation, until the special counsel got appointed, looks like it was moving forward. The Justice Department had agreed to make Weiss available. You know, there had been requests for Assistant U.S. Attorney Leslie Wolf, the DOJ tax attorney Mark Daley, who had been accused of obstructing some of the witnesses that could speak to the way this investigation was run, were on the docket to testify. Will that still take place? The Judiciary Committee says it will. The Justice Department, you know, if they have an excuse not to play ball, they'll probably take it.
Guaranteed.
But that, I think, will be the next, and potentially where more of the bombshells could come from, because we already kind of know a lot about the Biden family activity. Really, what's left is to dig into this nexus of Joe Biden's involvement.
Yeah. Yeah. A guy who doesn't get much discussion at all. Hunter's so sensational, right? Because there's all the really creepy stuff on the laptop, which we haven't even touched on. But there's, I mean, it's the drugs, the sex, the weirdness with what appears to be underage girls. There's just a lot of creepy, dark stuff on the laptop. So it's sensational. And so it's easy to point out and go, this guy's a train wreck. And so it gets all the attention. What about Joe Biden's brother?
Oh, my gosh. Thank you for asking. I'm writing a story about it right now.
Good.
From the Washington Examiner this week. He has been doing this for decades, right? Sort of trading off the Biden family name. And he was involved in a lot of this stuff with CEFC Energy. So was his wife. He's made a lot of money from the Biden family. And, you know, there's been reported anecdotes where he's walked into boardrooms and say, you know, people want to invest in Joe Biden, and that's why this firm matters. You know, apparently he was admonished at one point by the late Beau Biden for having said that in front of people. But that's been his model for a long time. And it really puts the lie to this Democratic talking point that Hunter Biden, you know, did all of this on his own accord and was just a troubled kid. He clearly was, and there's sympathy for him, but it puts the lie to it that multiple other family members were also engaged in the same thing, coming from totally different educational and professional backgrounds, all coalesced around these same money-making opportunities, where the only thing linking them was their ability to sell access to Joe Biden.
Right, and that's, I mean, his brother's the perfect example of that, and not as sensational. Probably a little more rough around the edges when it comes to his technique, as he said, coming in and just announcing, you want to invest in Joe
Biden. Right, old school Delaware.
Right, yeah. But not as sensational, right? There's no weirdness on the personal
level. There's no roadmap for it, right? He didn't leave a Rosetta Stone of emails laying around, so it's harder to look at his
involvement. Which I guess really, in the sense of being tougher to go after, if there's no paper trail, or if there's a very limited paper trail on his part, certainly no laptops, it's a tougher case to make. But it's good that you're doing a story on him. So at Judicial Watch, we've been doing a ton of work in this area as well. We try to get as many records and documents as we can and make them public. It's a never-ending story for us. I mean, we've been just kind of grinding away, and whatever we get, we make public. We throw up on our website and produce it or make it public so the public can understand what's going on. Before we wrap, tell our viewers and our listeners about where they can find your work, how they can follow you, and anything else that you kind of want to just throw out there as a by the way.
Thank you. Well, you know, I've been using Judicial Watch. So I used to cover the Clinton emails back in, 2015, 2016. Yep. You guys, I remember, would have batched it because, you know, it was y'all's lawsuit, right, that helped shake those loose.
The only reason anybody knows that Hillary Clinton had an email server is because of our litigation, not about Hillary Clinton, our litigation on Benghazi. Mm-hmm. Benghazi is the reason why the Hillary Clinton email server was discovered. Real fast, Benghazi happens. We file FOIA requests to everybody under the sun, trying to figure out what happened and why no one came to the rescue. And we get tons and tons of records, but there's like a hole in the donut, mm-hmm. right? Everybody's talking to everybody else, but there's one person who's conspicuously absent in all the traffic and discussions, Secretary of State. Mm-hmm. The government swears they've given us everything. They move to dismiss the case, which is what happens in FOIA litigation. And okay, the case is dismissed. About 9 months later, we get a very sheepish phone call from the State Department. And they say, we've just discovered another universe of records. What does that mean? So we said, well, what universe are you talking about? And they said, mm-hmm. well, the secretary has her own email server. And that's what blew up the whole story. Mm-hmm. That was the kind of the track that got you there. So that's context for you. So you were doing email.
Well, I remember. Yes, I was.
But you had covered that stuff earlier, mm-hmm. so you knew of our work from there. Yeah. So how can folks follow what you're doing now, and how do they follow you on social media or your other articles you've been doing?
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I write for the Washington Examiner just about every day, and my ex handle is Sarah C. Bedford.
Sarah C. Bedford, very good. Thank you so much for coming in and joining us.
Thanks for having me.
It was a wonderful conversation, a lot of fun, a lot of interesting stuff. And I hope that folks either viewing or listening to this it sparks thought, right? Because a lot of stuff just kind of blows by, and people just get 2-second little snippets of information. I think this is a good recap, and we appreciate you coming and joining us here in studio.
Thank you.
I'm Chris Farrell, On Watch.
Thanks for listening to Chris Farrell's On Watch podcast. For more information, visit www.judicialwatch.org, because no one is above the law.